The smoke industry. 1. 26 hours. I want to open this chapter with a confession, because it would be dishonest to write it any other way. In June 2026, I, the man writing a book called Guard Your Thoughts, signed a $5,000 contract and a 12-month loan without reading the fine print. I did it inside a 26-hour window, and almost everything in me knew, even as I did it, that something didn't add up. I'm not telling this to humiliate myself. I'm telling it because it's living proof of this book's thesis, that the first place they catch you is not your wallet. It's your thinking. If I, with 24 years of solving technical problems, professionally suspicious of cheap hooks that end up costing fortunes, the man who tells his own clients that the cloud is perpetual rent, disguised as a deal, if I walked almost all the way down the funnel, then no one is immune. And that, precisely, is what the smoke industry understands better than anyone. Let me reconstruct the 26 hours, because the mechanics matter. It all started with a video. One of those YouTube videos where a supremely confident man explains that the problem isn't you. It's your method. That there exists a neuro-emotional way of selling that multiplies your results by 3, by 5, by 10. A lot of money promised and, curiously, no concrete business. The business is secondary, and he's the one who hands you the method. Below the video, a $27 book, a black book. I downloaded it without thinking twice. I spend that much on coffee. But to download it, I handed over my email, my phone number, and my consent to receive calls and messages. The video sells the method. The $27 book buys your phone number. That mandatory opt-in was the real transaction. I hadn't bought a book. I had turned into a lead. What followed moved fast. An invitation to schedule a call, presented not as a sales call. That would have triggered my defenses. But as an assessment call, an evaluation, as if I were the one applying, the one asking to be accepted. The power dynamic was inverted from the first minute. On the call, the closer, because that's what he was, a high-ticket closer, a professional trained to persuade on commission, though his title reads senior specialist, didn't pressure me crudely. Quite the opposite. He asked me questions. Many questions about my frustrations, my goals, the money I was leaving on the table by not knowing how to sell. I felt heard. And when a person feels heard, the industry's own literature says, price stops being a barrier. At the end of that conversation, there was an offer. And alongside the offer, an elegant solution to the uncomfortable detail that I didn't have $5,000 liquid dollars to spend. Financing. Learn now. Pay later. A third-party company. A fintech. Real. Legitimate. Approved my loan in minutes. I signed the agreement with an e-signature. I signed the loan. The system welcomed me. You're in. Messages from the founder in the community. Onboarding. Autopay activated. 26 hours. From video to debt. $4,988 financed. Monthly payments of $453. A total of $5,441 with interest. A contract that. Read afterward. Afterward. Always afterward. Stated in plain language. All sales are final. No refund. Cancellations. Exchanges or credit will be issued. Final sale. And a loan that, per that same contract, survives any cancellation of the course. Even if I had second thoughts and returned everything, the debt would still be mine. I was not defrauded. This matters enough that I will repeat it several times in this chapter, because honesty is the only solid ground I have. The company is real. The founder is a real person. The method exists. The book exists and has good reviews. Nobody robbed me. I signed. I, with my 24 years of professional suspicion, clicked accept. That's why I'm writing this. Because the interesting question isn't, was I defrauded? The question is, how does a man trained to distrust hand over $5,000 in under a day to a system that understood my thoughts better than I was guarding them? The answer is this entire chapter. 2. The anatomy of smoke. When I finally sat down, too late, to do what I should have done before. Research. Read. Take the machine apart piece by piece, which is what I do with any system I don't understand. I discovered I hadn't fallen into an improvised trap. I had fallen into an architecture, one of the most finely tuned that exists. And like any good system, once you see the diagram, you can never again not see it. The high-ticket coaching funnel, high-ticket info coaching, has parts with proper names, and each one performs an exact function. It begins with the VSL, the video sales letter. It is not an informational video. It is persuasion at scale, asynchronous, running by itself day and night. The industry describes it without shame in its own manuals, a short video that hits the pain points and builds urgency, designed for offers of $5,000 or more, which once produced is evergreen and generates leads every day. Sometimes there isn't even a video. There's a pre-recorded webinar passing itself off as live. It is not a video that informs you. It is a salesman who never sleeps. Next comes the renamed call. The industry documents this itself. The strategy session, or clarity call, is sold as clarity over persuasion, as if it were coaching and not selling. And there's a line I found in the sector's own literature that left me cold, because it was a warning between professionals. Don't manipulate the prospect on the call. Those tricks can backfire with sophisticated buyers. That they need to warn against manipulation tells you everything about how normal it is. They call it an evaluation when it is a hunt, and the one being evaluated offers up his own neck. Then there's the closer. Many work on pure commission. 10, 15, 20% of each sale. No salary. No guarantee. The role became so profitable that there's now a course sold to turn you into a closer, another layer of the same business, selling the how to sell to the one who sells the how to sell. The only safe product in this industry is the course for selling it. And above everything sits the value ladder. The concept is brilliant in its cold logic. Nobody buys something expensive from a stranger, so you enter through a free or cheap offer. The bait. My $27 black book, and climb from there. $100 a month course, a $3,000 program, a $20,000-$30,000 inner circle. The economic engine is the advertising flywheel. They can spend fortunes on ads to attract you at near loss, because they know a percentage will climb the ladder and pay for the expensive back end. You pay for every rung. The ladder belongs to them. There's one more piece, and it's the one that hurt most to recognize, because it cuts straight into this book's thesis, the rationing of knowledge. In the jargon, it's called drip content. They don't hand you all the material at once. They release it on a calendar, week by week. The justification, pedagogical, they say, and it's true in part, spaced learning is real and it works. But the documentation from the course platforms themselves says something else in plain language. Dripping content reduces refunds, keeps the student from downloading everything, and then asking for a refund. In other words, knowledge is rationed, in part, so you can't evaluate what you bought before your refund window expires. Two motives at once, one honest, one commercial, living inside the same gesture. That ambiguity is the soul of this entire industry. They drip you the knowledge so that your right to return it evaporates first. I build systems, servers, networks. infrastructure, and I recognize a well-designed system when I see one. The smoke funnel is a well-designed system. It's not magic, and it's not crude fraud. It's persuasion engineering, assembled piece by piece over a century. And to understand where it came from, we have to look back. 3. The lineage. None of this is new. What happened to me in 26 hours is the 2026 version of a business nearly 100 years old, and the lineage is consistent enough to be chilling. The same intellectual DNA, repeated generation after generation. The founding father is Napoleon Hill, with Think and Grow Rich, from 1937. He practically invented the get rich with your mind genre. The problem, and I say this on evidence gathered by journalists who dug through the court records of his era, is that Hill was also a documented con man, a timber fraud he fled from creditors over, an arrest for altering checks, an unaccredited school with arrest warrants attached, FTC charges against his own magazine, and the very heart of his myth that Andrew Carnegie received him in 1908 and commissioned a 20-year study of success, has no evidence behind it at all. Carnegie's definitive biographer, David Nassau, was blunt. I found no evidence of any kind that Carnegie and Hill ever met. Hill's own official biographers admit the famous interview was largely fiction. Conveniently, Hill never claimed that meeting until after Carnegie was dead and could no longer deny it. The man who invented the genre of mind your thoughts to get rich lied about the origin of his own authority. This isn't a detail. It's the pattern. From there, the lineage branches off with almost genetic cleanliness, and it can be told in a single breath. Nightingale distills Hill onto a record. We become what we think about, 1956, and opens the era of motivational audio. Ziegler puts the salesman on stage. Robbins takes him to the stadium and leaves 21 pairs of feet burned on the coals. Kiyosaki confesses that the rich dad of rich dad poor dad was a character. Cardone turns 10X into a brand and today faces a securities fraud lawsuit. Belfort, the real wolf of Wall Street, gets out of prison and sells persuasion courses. 6 names, one single product. And at the end of the chain, today is the version that caught me, the guru who isn't a criminal fraudster or a con man with a record, but something more subtle. A genuinely talented salesman with a real book and a real company whose only sin, but it's a sin that defines everything, is that his marketing apparatus inflates and rewrites his own story. Student count figures that grow with no audit from version to version, from 180,000 to 459,000, depending on where you read. The ranking of the 45th out of 100 million salespeople, whose source no one names. The corporate top earner narrative that, when you scratch it, was born inside multi-level marketing companies sued over alleged pyramid schemes. The original neuro-emotional method that, according to critics, is a repackaging of an earlier course that cost 10 times less. The connecting threads are always the same. An idea inherited from a century ago, repainted as novelty. A borrowed or invented authority. Extraordinary returns attributed to the method, impossible to audit. And regulatory scrutiny that chases down the worst cases decade after decade. The FTC dismantling business education schemes worth $125 million, $362 million, $1.2 billion. The damage is real, it's documented, and it's old. What changes is only the funnel's technology. From books to records, from records to seminars, from seminars to television, from television to YouTube, and the loan approved in minutes. The promise is the same as in 1937. Think correctly and wealth will come. What's never there, in any version, is the concrete business that produces that wealth, only the method for selling it. 4. The spectrum of coercion. Here I have to stop and be very careful, because it's easy and tempting to slide into defamation. And defamation is the opposite of guarding your thoughts. When you feel deceived, the instinctive reaction is to shout cult. I was brainwashed. I felt it. And precisely because I felt it, I forced myself to investigate before accusing. What I found made me turn the volume down. And I think that turning down is one of the most honest gifts I can give you as a reader. There is no clean line between legitimate marketing and cult. There is a spectrum. And placing yourself correctly on that spectrum is the difference between thinking and reacting. The spectrum has three stations, and it's worth naming them quickly before walking them. At one end, legitimate, aggressive marketing. It uses the persuasion principles the psychologist Robert Cialdini cataloged 4 decades ago. Reciprocity, social proof, authority, scarcity. And the line isn't in using scarcity, but in whether the scarcity is real. Its fuel is hype, the noise that promises more than it weighs. In the middle, multi-level marketing, MLM, legal, but designed so that almost everyone loses. An ARP survey found 3 out of 4 participants with no gain at all. And at the far end, the genuine coercive group, rare, extreme, and, this is the crucial part, not where the sales coaching that sold me my course lies. Instead of a table, I'll leave you the test I ordered myself to take once the anger came down. I call it the test of the door, and it is 3 20-second scenes, from lesser to greater. First, the car salesman who squeezes you with this deal dies today, pure FOMO, the fear of missing out, and who, the moment you say yes, already has the accessories upsell ready. If you give in, you lose money, you hang up the phone, and your life goes on. Second, the cousin in the MLM who turns the family dinner into a recruiting session. You lose money and patience, and maybe an after-dinner conversation, but the door stays open. Third, the group that asks you to stop talking to anyone who doubts it, that decides what you may read, and that charges you the exit fee in public confession. Here you no longer lose money. You lose yourself. And the pocket rule that replaces any table. Don't measure how much they excite you. Measure how much the door costs you. If you can leave losing only money, it's marketing. Aggressive, perhaps unworthy, but marketing. If leaving costs you your people, your information, or your name, it is something else, and it is rare. Here comes the part I found hardest to accept, because it ran against my anger. The idea of deterministic brainwashing, the idea that a technique can override your will and turn you into an automaton, is not accepted science. I'm not the one saying so. The record is, in 1987, the American Psychological Association rejected a report on coercive persuasion methods for lacking the scientific rigor required. In 1990, a federal court in United States v. Fishman excluded expert testimony on coercive persuasion for the same reason, and the sociologist Eileen Barker, after studying more than 1,000 people exposed to a supposedly brainwashing movement, found that the great majority did not join. The techniques, manufactured urgency, inflated authority, social proof, the funnel that inverts the power dynamic, are real, observable, and can be described. But their effect is not deterministic. What does this mean for my case, and for yours? That I kept my agency. Nobody brainwashed me. I signed. And I am responsible for having signed. Saying I was manipulated, and therefore it's not my fault, would be lying to myself, and it would be repeating the same magical thinking I'm criticizing, just inverted. The program I bought lives on the wide side of the spectrum, a high-priced, self-referential guru with inflated marketing. It isn't a cult. It isn't a fraud. And calling it that wouldn't just be unfair to them. It would mean giving up precision, which is exactly what a well-guarded thought refuses to do. What I can say plainly is that I was sold an expensive shortcut whose effectiveness has no independent proof, financed with a debt that survives my regret. That's enough. I don't need to inflate the accusation for it to hurt. 5. The irony that proves it all. And now I come to the finding that, when I found it, first made me laugh and then made me go quiet, because it turned out the betrayal began in the most intimate place possible, in the very phrase that gives this book its name. The motto I live by, watch your thoughts, for they become words. Watch your words, for they become actions. That chain ending in destiny circulates around the world attributed to Lao Tzu, sometimes to Buddha, sometimes to Emerson, to Margaret Thatcher. People tattoo it, hang it in offices, quoted in talks as ancient Eastern wisdom. It isn't from Lao Tzu. It isn't from Buddha. The full version first appears documented in a San Antonio newspaper in May 1977, attributed to Frank Outlaw, president of a supermarket chain, a grocery store executive from the 1970s. The ancient wisdom is barely half a century old, and it was born in American corporate life, not in a monastery. And it isn't the only one. Its twin quote, "We are what we repeatedly do." Excellence, then, is not an act but a habit, is universally attributed to Aristotle. It isn't his either. It belongs to the historian Will Durant, who in 1926 was summarizing in his own words an idea of Aristotle's, and posterity handed it to the philosopher. Do you see the irony? It's perfect, it's ruthless, and it proves this book's entire thesis better than any argument I could construct. Whoever doesn't guard their thoughts repeats false quotes with the same ease they repeat false promises, attributing a shopkeeper's line to Lao Tzu to make it sound wiser, is exactly the same mental operation as attributing wealth to the neuro-emotional method to make it sound more scientific, or inventing a meeting with Carnegie to make your book sound more authoritative. It's Cialdini's authority, bias operating in plain sight. We dress an idea in a prestigious name it doesn't deserve, because naked truth feels insufficient to us. The smoke industry didn't invent this operation. It only industrialized it. And here is my decision, the one that orders this book. I will not claim for my motto an ancient pedigree it doesn't have. I will acknowledge it for what it is, 20th century folk wisdom, and anchor it where it does have true, verifiable roots. Because it has them, and they're far sturdier than an invented attribution. The idea that your thoughts define you doesn't need an apocryphal Lao Tzu. It has the Stoics, and they truly wrote what they wrote. Epictetus opens his manual with the most liberating distinction I know. Some things are within our power. Our opinions, our desires, our aversions, our acts, and others are not. The body, property, reputation, office. This is called the internal locus of control, and modern cognitive therapy descends directly from it. Marcus Aurelius wrote it, in his Meditations, in a line that is genuinely his. Book 5, passage 16. The soul takes on the color of its thoughts, not the version that circulates on posters, but that one, the real one. And Seneca, 2,000 years ago, described exactly the mechanism the smoke industry exploits. Putting things off is the greatest waste of life. It robs us of the present by promising us the future. We are stingy with our money. he said, but wasteful with our time. Read that line from Seneca again and think about my loan. The smoke industry sells promised future in exchange for real present. It charges you today, in money and in time, for a wealth that will arrive later. It places your happiness in the external. Money, status, the magic method, which is exactly the column Epictetus declares outside your power. And everything outside your power, if you depend on it, is a guarantee of anxiety. At the exact opposite pole from Stoicism sits the magical thinking this modern industry inherited from the New Thought movement. The law of attraction, popularized by The Secret, labeled pseudoscience with no scientific basis whatsoever, with its cruel flip side of blaming the victim. If you get sick, if your business fails, it's because you didn't think hard enough. That is the perverse inversion of guard your thoughts. It replaces the moral chain, thought, act, habit, character, with pure magic, thought, material result, skipping every link in between. Precisely the links where the work lives, and where virtue lives. Six, the antidote. So what does it really mean to guard your thoughts? After my 26 hours, I understand it in a way I could previously only sense. Guarding your thoughts has two faces, and they are the same skill seen from two sides. The first face is defensive. Guarding your thoughts means watching the automatic judgments that manipulative marketing tries to ignite in you, the urgency that squeezes you, the authority that impresses you, the social proof that sweeps you along, the inversion of power that makes you feel you're the one begging to be let in. The Stoics had a word for this vigilance, prosage, continuous attention. And it turns out to be operationally identical to what Cialdini recommends as the only defense against his own principles, awareness and critical thought, not blind obedience to authority figures. The manipulator enters first through your thinking, because that's where you're least protected. Whoever watches that first link becomes nearly immune. I didn't watch it that night. That's the lesson I paid $453 a month for. The second phase is constructive, and it's where my entire life reconciles with this book. I am a problem solver. I've spent 24 years creating real value for real people. I built my first server in 2004. In a Kodak lab in Mexico, so photographers would stop losing hours traveling to deliver physical memory cards. With that, I erased 2 or 3 days of pointless logistics from the lives of people who worked hard. I sold Francisco, a 50-year-old photographer who kept his memory cards in envelopes inside a shoebox, a server he's still using 7 years later. He left the shoebox behind and never went back. I showed a company how to get out of a cloud that was about to charge it $24,000 a month and recoup the investment in 3 or 4 months. That's creating value. You solve a concrete problem, and the other person ends up measurably, verifiably better off. That's the line between the problem solver and the smoke salesman, and it's sharp. The problem solver delivers a solution you can audit. A server that works, an invoice that drops, a process that speeds up. The smoke salesman delivers a method and a testimonial. And when you ask for the concrete case, the named company, the verifiable figures, you find an anonymous case study and testimonials from individuals with no data attached. I lived this firsthand. I went looking for proof that the method I bought worked inside real organizations, and there wasn't a single named case with auditable numbers. Logos, yes. Proof, no. And here is the refrain I need to say out loud, because it touches my own tension. I also charge for knowledge. I use open source software and charge people to install and configure it, and it sometimes makes me uncomfortable. But there's an enormous difference between charging for expertise that produces a verifiable result and charging for the promise of a shortcut whose result you cannot prove. Red Hat charges millions for Linux, which is free, because the value isn't the code. It's the expertise, the support, the guarantee that it will work. The software is free. The knowledge that makes it useful is not. That's my line, and the smoke industry crosses it not because it charges a high price, but because what it charges a high price for doesn't deliver what it promises, and it rations the knowledge so you can't verify that in time. My mission, the reason I build what I build, is to generate wealth in order to help others and to narrow the gap of financial inequality. Wealth, for me, is a means to serve, not an identity you buy. And there is the smoke industry's deepest moral crack. It sells wealth as identity. It promises that by buying the method you become the kind of person who is rich. But identity isn't bought. It's built, link by link, through repeated acts. Which is exactly what my motto says, and exactly what the shortcut denies. 7. Who you are. My motto ends like this. Your acts become habits, and your habits reveal who you are. I think a great deal about that word. Reveal. Not build, though they also build. Reveal. Your habits give you away. They show, with no room to lie, who you truly are beneath what you claim to be. And that's what hits me hardest about the 26 hours. Because the smoke industry is a business whose central habit, repeated for a century, from Hill to today, is promising a destination without doing the work of the links in between. It sells you the first link, the thought, and the last, the destiny, and erases everything in the middle. The act, the habit, the character, exactly where virtue lies. And that habit of erasing the work reveals what that industry is, something that needs you not to look too closely. But the motto cuts both ways, and that's why I can't point without pointing at myself. My habit that night was not reading the fine print. It was letting myself be swept along by speed. It was silencing the voice I've spent 24 years training to distrust hooks. That habit revealed something about me, that not even the man writing about guarding his thoughts is exempt from failing to guard them when the machine is well designed and the night is long. What do I do with what I learned? 3 things, and they are habits, not thoughts, because this chapter's lesson is precisely that thoughts aren't enough. First, I read the fine print before signing. Always, without exception, even when I'm told the spots are running out. Manufactured urgency is smoke's fingerprint. Second, I demand auditable proof. When someone promises me a result, I ask for the named case, the verifiable figures, the real company. If all there is are anonymous testimonials and logos with no numbers, I already know which column of the spectrum I'm standing in. Third, and most important, I turn the money I already spent into something. The debt exists and is hard to reverse. The rational move is to wring out what I paid for and, above all, to write this, so that what cost me $5,441 costs you only the time it takes to read it. That's the only honest return on investment I can see in my mistake. I wasn't brainwashed. Nobody defrauded me. I signed, with my own hand, a shortcut that my own life disproves, because I spent my whole life proving there are no shortcuts, that the server has to be built, that a client's trust has to be earned by watching it work live, that real value is slow and verifiable, and that's precisely why it's real. For one night, I fell for the promise that a short path existed. And the only reason I can write this chapter without shame is that the motto stayed true even while I was betraying it. My thoughts defined my act. My act could have become a habit. And I chose, instead, to make it a warning. Guard your thoughts. Not because a Lao Tzu quote that's actually from a San Antonio shopkeeper says so prettily. Guard them because they are the first door, and because there's an entire industry, a century old and tuned to perfection, waiting to come through it. You're the one who guards that door. No one else can. There is an expression I have used for years and that I refuse to paraphrase, because every paraphrase I find comes up short. Right on the spot, at the exact point. I say it when a diagnosis lands squarely where the fault was, when the cable you replace turns out to be the one, when the word you say comes down on the center of the problem and not on its surroundings. It is an expression of marksmanship, and marksmanship is exactly what this chapter charged me for and taught me, because an unguarded thought fires in every direction, at the excuse, at the promise, at whoever happens to be standing nearby. A guarded thought does the opposite. It holds still over the problem until it hits it. Guarding my thoughts has been training that aim in me, in the servers, in my recovery, in this very 26-hour mistake that ended up becoming a chapter. That is why I close this way, with the expression I use to celebrate every shot that finds its mark. This time the target was me. Right on the spot. Notes and sources. This chapter draws on the project's underlying research, where every claim is classified as verifiable fact, interpretation, or hypothesis, with its corresponding citation, primary research, about 160 sources, the project's study on the high-ticket coaching industry. From it come the mechanics of the high-ticket funnel, VSL, clarity call, closer, value ladder, drip content, the historical lineage, Hill, Carnegie, Nightingale, Ziegler, Robbins, Kiyosaki, Cardone, Belfort with its documented controversies, the spectrum of coercion and its academic counterweight, APA DIMPAC 1987, US v. Fishman 1990, Eileen Barker, the regulatory action of the FTC and the SEC, and the philosophical angle, the Frank Outlaw 1977 attribution via quote investigator, Will Durant 1926 via Snopes, Epictetus, the genuine meditations 5.16, Seneca, the secret as pseudoscience, Cialdini, the lived case 7th level, Nepke, Jeremy Miner, the project's due diligence dossiers. From these come the contract and loan data, final sale, loan of about $5,441 with $453.48 payments, about a 26-hour window, the verdict of a high-priced, self-referential guru with inflated marketing, not fraud nor a cult, the inconsistent student count figures, and the absence of auditable cases. The author's voice, cases, and thesis. Roberto Acampo's personal archive, Codec 2004. Francisco, the data sovereignty case. The tension of charging for knowledge about open source software. The mission of creating real value. Attributions are used and they're corrected. Honest version, where the evidence falls short of an accusation. The text deliberately tempers it, describing techniques and concrete harms, never positing brainwashing or cult without extreme, verifiable evidence.